Good evening. Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Attorney General William Barr has committed a crime, and Representative Jared Nadler makes a threat to hold him accountable.
He does not provide this committee with the information it demands and the respect it deserves. Mr. Barr's moment of accountability will come soon enough.
And in New York, neighbors decry the city's plan for an express bus lane. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Thursday, May 2, 2019. President Donald Trump's tweeted Thursday that his planned nominee for the Federal Reserve Board has withdrawn his name from consideration. In his announcement, Trump called Mr. Moore, the great pro-growth economist and a truly fine person, and said he's asking him to work with him in another capacity. The announcement came only hours after Moore told Bloomberg News that he was all in on the role despite mounting pushback from GOP lawmakers, and that he would only withdraw his name from consideration if Trump wanted him to. Economist Jack Erasmus says Moore is a right-winger who has criticized the current Fed leadership for its moves to raise interest rates.
Stephen Moore is a right-wing intellectual associated with the Think Tank Heritage Foundation. He was one of those who came out very publicly in December attacking Fed Chair Jerome Powell for raising interest rates at the time that we had a crescendo of criticism of the Fed, not just Trump, but Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, held an emergency meeting right before Christmas of a dozen or so big capitalists who came. We don't know who they were. There was almost a near panic at the time because the stock market was dropping 30-40%, and the economy looked like it was really slowing down dramatically. And Trump, who's been criticizing the Fed for some time, escalated his criticism. And Moore was somebody who called for the firing of Jerome Powell, which is something the president can't do. And, of course, Trump started saying, I'm going to fire you if you raise interest rates, you know, so much for the fiction of central bank independence. So now Trump, now that he got Powell to do a 180-degree turn and stop raising interest rates and stop selling off the debt that the Fed accumulated in the last crisis, in other words, no rate hikes now or in 2020, now Trump is pushing, and you see this right-wing push, conservative business push, to get the Fed to lower interest rates here before the election.
Stephen Moore is perhaps most well-known for regularly flubbing comments about the economy and media appearances, and for overseeing a disastrous 2012 tax cut experiment in Kansas that led to state revenues falling $700 million overnight. Moore's also had to explain past racist and sexist comments this week, including a joke that Barack Obama lived in public housing and remarks that women shouldn't be involved in sports. Trump had to make a similar announcement last week about Herman Cain, one of his other potential nominees for the two vacant Federal Reserve Board seats. As was the case with Moore, Cain lacked support from Republican senators, largely due to his facing sexual harassment allegations and launching a pro-Trump super PAC last year. Meanwhile, Attorney General William Barr's refusal to appear before the House Judiciary Committee has led to more teeth gnashing among Democrats, still fired up after Wednesday's grilling of Barr before the Senate Judiciary Committee. On Thursday, Democrats in the House blasted Barr for skipping the hearing and accused the executive branch of subverting constitutional checks and balances by undermining Congress. Chairman Gerald Nadler addressed an empty chair as colleague Steve Cohen chewed on a bucket of fried chicken, a stunt to imply Barr was a coward for failing to attend. Nadler said the White House is demanding a gag order on any members who see the redacted or uncensored or censored portions of Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller's report. Nadler says that's unacceptable.
Late last night, the Department of Justice wrote to inform us that they will ignore our subpoena for the unredacted Mueller report and the underlying evidence. They have made no meaningful attempt at accommodating that subpoena, which was due yesterday. The letter references the Attorney General's offer to 12 members of Congress, 12 out of 435, to look behind some, but not all, of the redactions, provided that we agree not to discuss what we see with our colleagues and that we leave our notes behind at the Department of Justice. It is urgent that we see the documents we have subpoenaed, but I cannot agree to conditions that prevent me from discussing the full report with my colleagues and that prevent the House from acting on the full report in any meaningful way. An accommodation designed to prevent us from taking official action is no accommodation at all. Every member of this committee, Democrat and Republican alike, should understand the consequences when the executive branch tells us that they will simply ignore a lawful subpoena from Congress. If left unchecked, this act of obstruction will make it that much harder for us to hold the executive branch accountable for waste, fraud, and abuse, or to enact legislation to curb that kind of misconduct, or any kind of misconduct, no matter which party holds this chamber or the White House at a given moment. The challenge we face is also bigger than the Mueller report. If all we knew about President Trump were contained in the four corners of that report, there would be good reason to question his fitness for office. But the report is not where the story ends. In the days since the Department of Justice released the redacted version of the report, President Trump has told Congress that he plans to fight all of our subpoenas. The average person is not free to ignore a congressional subpoena, nor is the president. His promise to obstruct our work extends far beyond his contacts with the Russian government and allegations of obstruction of justice. The president has also prevented us from obtaining information about voting rights, ACA litigation, and his cruel family separation policy, among other matters. The challenge we face is also not limited to this committee. In recent weeks, administration witnesses have simply failed to show for properly noticed depositions. The Secretary of the Treasury continues to ignore his clear statutory obligation to produce the president's tax returns. The president's private attorneys sued Chairman Cummings in his personal capacity in an attempt to block the release of certain financial documents. Ladies and gentlemen, the challenge we face is that the President of the United States wants desperately to prevent Congress, a co-equal branch of government, from providing any check whatsoever to even his most reckless decisions. He is trying to render Congress inert as a separate and co-equal branch of government. The challenge we face is that if we don't stand up to him together today, we risk forever losing the power to stand up to any president in the future. The very system of government of the United States, the system of limited power, the system of not having a president as a dictator is very much at stake. The Attorney General of the United States is sworn to uphold the Constitution as our nation's chief law enforcement officer. He has an obligation to do everything in his power to warn the president of the damage he risks and the liability he assumes by directly threatening our system of checks and balances and of limited government. Sadly, the Attorney General has failed in that responsibility. He has failed to check the president's worst instincts. He has not only misrepresented the findings of the special counsel, he has failed to protect the special counsel's investigation from unfair political attacks. He has himself unfairly attacked the special counsel's investigation. He has failed the men and women of the Department of Justice by placing the needs of the president over the fair administration of justice. He has even failed to show up today. Yes, we will continue to negotiate for access to the full report for another couple of days. And yes, we will have no choice but to move quickly to hold the Attorney General in contempt if he stalls or fails to negotiate in good faith. But the Attorney General must make a choice. Every one of us must make the same choice. That choice is now an obligation of our office. The choice is simple. We can stand up to this president in defense of the country and the Constitution and the liberty we love, or we can let the moment pass us by. I do not, and we have seen in other countries what happens when you allow such moments to pass by. I do not know what Attorney General Barr will choose. I do not know what my Republican colleagues will choose. But I am certain that there is no way forward for this country that does not include a reckoning with this clear and present danger to our constitutional order. History will judge us for how we face this challenge. We will all be held accountable in one way or the other. And if he does not provide this committee with the information it demands and the respect it deserves, Mr. Barr's moment of accountability will come soon enough.
The conflict between the GOP and Democrats revolves around Nadler's demand that staff attorneys be allowed to question Barr, a move that would subject the attorney general to more intrusive questioning than he's experienced so far on the matter. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi joined the fray later on Thursday. She says the dispute is really over the right-wing agenda of special interests being shielded by Trump.
Mitch McConnell, Donald Trump, Attorney General Barr, there's a connection. There is an ideological anti-governance, anti-science, anti-meeting the needs of the American people. So when he was testifying and being so cavalier about Special Counsel Mueller and the Mueller report and so disrespectful of Congress, I thought this isn't about President Trump only. It's about a right-wing ideological handmaiden, they're handmaidens to the special interest in our country. And it's important to connect the dots, but the American people have to know what this means to them. If you're a young person, you care about the climate crisis. We're passing that bill right now on the floor, and I'm going to have to leave momentarily to vote for it. It is, and that's going to be dead on arrival in the Senate. If you care, if you're a young person, you care about net neutrality, freedom on the internet. The Grim Reaper is going to kill it in the Senate. If you're a woman, Violence Against Women Act, equal pay for equal work that we sent over to the Senate, the Grim Reaper, Mitch McConnell, will kill it. If you care about reducing the role of money in politics as H.R. 1, legislation stopping the voter suppression and expanding the voice of the people in our political process, Mitch McConnell will kill it because he has said the problem is not too much money in politics. He says there's not enough money in politics. Our H.R. 1 is about expanding the voice of the people. Their H.R. 1 was giving 83% of the tax benefit to the top 1%. So this is about policy. It's also about gun safety. Gun safety. We sent over H.R. 8 and H.R. 1112 for responsible background checks. Handmaidens to the National Rifle Association and the special interest. Connect the dots. When you see Barr sitting there, what's his motivation? His motivation, his loyalty, is not to his oath of office, and it is to Donald Trump, but all of it, and the Republicans in Congress, is to the special interest.
Pelosi went on to accuse Attorney General Barr of committing a crime by lying to Congress.
The Attorney General of the United States of America was not telling the truth to the Congress of the United States. That's a crime.
Speaker Pelosi, what kinds of consequences are you considering for members of the administration who don't comply with congressional subpoenas?
Well, I have great confidence in our committees. We have six committees that have, five of them have subpoenas. So far, we don't have one from the Foreign Affairs Committee. But five of the six committees of jurisdiction have the potential for subpoenas. They haven't all issued subpoenas, but that's where we see some of that activity. As you probably know, when the articles of impeachment for President Nixon, Article 3, was that he ignored the subpoenas of Congress, that he did not honor the subpoenas of Congress. This is very, very serious. But my judgment will spring from the judgment of our committee chairs. And in terms of, I'm just looking at Mr. Nadler's statement. In the close of his statement today relating to the Attorney General, he said, "History will judge us on how we face this challenge. We will be held accountable one way or another." And Barr does not provide this committee with the information it demands and the respect it deserves, Mr. Barr's moment of accountability will come soon enough. And I think that probably applies, whatever they decide.
Jail time should be on the table?
I said the committees are trying to make accommodations in terms of receiving unredacted the Mueller report. Let them work their will, and then we'll go to the next step.
Madam Speaker, did the Attorney General commit a crime?
He lied to Congress. He lied to Congress. If anybody else did that, it would be considered a crime. Nobody is above the law, not the President of the United States and not the Attorney General. Being the Attorney General does not give you a bath to go say whatever you want, and it is the fact because you are the Attorney General.
Should
it just
isn't
jail?
True. Should he go to jail for it?
There's a process involved here, and as I said, I'll say it again, and how many other questions you may have, the committee will act upon how we will proceed.
Meanwhile, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy says the Democrats' move to question Barr with experienced investigators was a breach of rules and that the Attorney General has been transparent with Congress.
I do not believe Attorney General Barr lied. I believe he's been very transparent in all of this. I think if people are looking at who has lied in the process, simply look at Chairman Nadler. Chairman Nadler asked the Attorney General to come, and he said yes. After the Attorney General said he would come to the committee to speak to every member, they moved to change the rules. Even CNN cannot find any history of that happening before. The only time an individual, a staffer, questioned somebody was during Watergate. Nadler has been wanting to impeach the day after the election. He can't have the facts to prove of why he should, but he will not stop. This is what the American public is frustrated by, the politics of attacking individuals. When you look at the Democratic Party, they now want to weaponize the IRS. They want to continue to go after the president and try to go after his family. This has got to stop. The American public wants us to move forward and solve the problems.
In related news, Representative Nadler says negotiations are continuing over finding a date, perhaps in May, when the special counsel can testify before the committee. Barr has said he has no objections to Mueller making an appearance, and Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway also says Mueller, who is still technically a Justice Department employee, can testify. According to reports, if Barr doesn't respond to a subpoena, Congress could make a criminal referral for lying to Congress. That would be forwarded to U.S. attorneys in the Justice Department, headed by William Barr. The House of Representatives would also vote or could also vote to formally censure the Attorney General, putting a black mark on his record, but not much more. Finally, they could try to impeach the Attorney General and have him removed from office. The process would be similar to that for removing a U.S. president, a majority vote in the House of Representatives, followed by a trial in the U.S. Senate requiring 2/3 vote to convict. Only one White House cabinet official has ever been impeached, Ulysses S. Grant, Secretary of War William Belknap, in 1876, and he was ultimately acquitted of corruption charges by the Senate. The House is also calling former White House counsel Don McGahn to testify about his assertions Trump suggested he fire Mueller and later write a memo saying Trump issued no such directive. Barr told the Senate on Wednesday the president only suggested Mueller be replaced because of a perceived conflict of interest and then instructed McGahn to write a memo to correct inaccurate media reports. Nadler has issued a subpoena for McGahn to testify before the committee on May 21st so his committee can get the former Trump's aides account directly. Trump has said he plans to fight all the congressional subpoenas his administration is receiving, with McGahn's reportedly high on the list. Concurrently, there are two separate legal battles brewing over congressional requests for Trump's business records and that holy grail for many, his tax returns. A month ago, Richard Neal, the Democrat in charge of the House Ways and Means Committee, formally requested that the Internal Revenue Service provide him with copies of the president's tax returns for 6 years. So far, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin has only said he's reviewing the matter. Trump and his lawyers have called the request improper and insisted the IRS not comply. Trump's personal lawyers filed a flurry of lawsuits to prevent an accountant firm and two banks used by Trump's businesses, Deutsche Bank and Capital One, from complying with requests by several Democratic-controlled House committees for Trump Organization financial records. Trump's lawyers are painting the move as a partisan fishing expedition that intrudes on the privacy of the president and his family. And in local news, the L train is chugging along 1 week into service changes for construction necessitated by flooding from Superstorm Sandy in 2012. While computers were spared an 18-month shutdown of one of the city's busiest lines running through the Canarsie Tunnel by a last-minute reprieve from Governor Mario Cuomo, some local residents feel their concerns have been ignored. That includes elderly folks along the M14 bus line that serves the East Village on Avenue A and Avenue D, as well as along 14th Street. The city is replacing some of the local stops with SBS service running express and skipping many former bus stops. The protest Wisen community saw dozens of local residents using walkers and canes to make a slow march down Grand Street Wednesday morning. The handmade protest signs included declarations such as "Select bus is elder abuse" and "Save our bus stops." The city plans to install the SBS service in June, when they will also restrict most of 14th Street to truck and local deliveries, as well as dedicated bus lines. A spokesperson for the 14th Street Coalition is Judy Pessin. She says the mayor's plan for the 14th Street is not what local residents wanted.
We're not happy about it. We, the neighbors, and the coalition is made up of members from the Village, Chelsea, up to Flatiron, because we'll all be impacted by vehicles being diverted off of 14th Street. And the truth is, we can't see the justification. The original plan for the busway was when there were supposed to be 84,000 people every day coming above ground, and now the primary hours for this vehicle van, the L train is going to be running, you know, at full regular speed. The band, we haven't seen the final hours, but the proposal has always been 5 a.m. to 10 p.m., but the L train is running from 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. So this is really a draconian solution to something that we don't see as a problem. What we had wanted was the DOT option number two, which they floated over the last month or so, which called for dedicated bus lanes, but also allowing for through traffic lanes. Mm-hmm. And that had been what we supported. So the concern is, I mean, we've got a bunch of concerns, but primarily diverting all these vehicles, because they're still going to come to this part of town. We're assuming they're here for a reason, and they'll be off on the side streets. Mm-hmm. And our side streets are already congested. This is going to add a significant amount. Again, we don't see the justification. Weekends and nights are a different story. We understand that there will be service. It won't be zero service. There will be service. But during the week, where does this come from?
The mayor said that this is an experiment and that it's necessary to do these experiments because of the traffic problems and his Vision Zero
right.
approach.
So two things about the mayor's press release. I don't know of a pilot that lasts 18 months. You want to see how something works, you know, 3 months, 6 months, 18 months, I think is a very long time. But frankly, his quote in this press release said that this experiment, and so he's making us guinea pigs here, if successful, could provide another tool to move buses faster and save people valuable time for the things that matter. But what it's telling us that live here is that he doesn't care about the things that matter to us. He's talking about saving 10, 15 minutes of valuable commuter time and not concerned about the impact on the residents. And by the way, Paul, we're commuters. I take subways. I take the M14 bus. You know, we're impacted as well, but we don't see that this is a solution that takes into account the commuters and the community. We think, again, it's just looking at commuters. So a commuter who passes through our neighborhoods for, I don't know, half an hour a day, yeah, we're going to be impacted 24/7. It doesn't sound like a balance to me.
So what do you think is going to happen? The cars are going to go?
If the L train were closing, it's a different story, but it's not, and it's going to be operational. It sounds really punishing.
Once every 20 minutes, it was going to be for the L train from now on. So there'll be
just nights and weekends, just after 8 p.m.
But
it's running normal, absolutely normal capacity till 8 p.m. from 5 in the morning. And President Byford, MTA president, said either 80 or 90%, 90% was his number, we're not going to be impacted because for a normal workday, the trains are running as normal. It's 8 p.m. at night till 5 in the morning and weekends. And I can tell you that over the last year and a half, because unfortunately I've been involved in this for a year and a half, the L train's been closed for about a dozen weekends, full weekends, Friday night to Monday morning, and they've just added some extra buses across 14th Street.
And that's Judy Pessin, a spokesperson for the 14th Street Coalition. And finally, Baltimore's mayor resigned today under pressure amid a flurry of investigations into whether she arranged bulk sales of her self-published children's books to disguise hundreds of thousands of dollars in kickbacks. Mayor Catherine Pugh's resignation came exactly a week after her city hall offices, homes, and multiple other locations were raided by FBI and IRS agents. She's the second mayor in less than a decade to step down because of scandal. She came to office contrasting her clean image with her main opponent, ex-mayor Sheila Dixon, who was forced to depart office in 2010 as part of a plea deal for misappropriating about $500 in gift cards meant for needy families. She said, "I'm sorry for the harm that I've caused to the image of the city of Baltimore and the credibility of the office of the mayor." A federal grand jury has been impaneled, and state and local inquiries are also underway into the roughly $800,000 Pugh made over the years in exchange for her Healthy Holly paperbacks about health and nutrition. She hasn't been charged with any crime. And that's some of the news for Thursday, May 2nd, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is James Irsay. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Thanks for joining us.